You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 21st of June 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are broadcasting live tonight at RadioAryan.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, happy solstice to you. Happy Midsummer's Eve to you, or Midsummer's Day, or whatever it is. It's the middle of the summer here. Yes. Has it been a good day there? A nice, sunny, glorious summer's day?
Yeah, actually, has been very good. Yeah, it's amazing. Seems to come off YouTube. The weather's picked up. Life has looked a lot wonderful.
Excellent. That's good to hear. It just seems to be brightening up a little bit here now as well. I was thinking, what's happened to the summer? And so it's back again. It's good. Things are good, and I'm back. I've been away all week. I've had guests around here, so I haven't been able to do any programs, not any live programs. They were all pre-recorded. So this is actually the first podcast that I've done for about a week now.
Thank you.
Yes. So I'm glad to be doing the podcast with you, Dennis. And you're telling me you've been doing some work on the next episode of the documentary series, have you?
Yes, I'm inching there. You've already got a sample of some of the fresh work that I found, thanks to my contacts out there. And as soon as I saw it, I actually thought, well, I better get this over to my mate Sven, because I'm sure he's going to be interested in this piece of work, what's been sent to me.
Definitely. And what you've got here is, I mean, it's a memo, basically, an Allied military memo that bears out the truth of everything that you've been saying. It comes from Vienna. It's from January the 10th, 1948, it's memo number 31/48, and it says the Allied Committee of Inquiry has to date proven that no poison gas was ever used to kill prisoners in the following concentration camps. And then it says Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Dachau, Flossenbürg, Gross-Rosen, Mauthausen, and satellite camps, Natzweiler, Neuengamme, Niederhagen, Wevelsburg, Ravensbrück, Sachsenhausen, Stutthof, Theresienstadt. In all cases where gassings were alleged, it could be proven that torture was used to extract confessions and witnesses have lied. Any former inmate who during their debriefing continues to allege that poison gas was used to murder people, in particular Jews, are to be reported to this office, and if they insist on lying further, they are to be charged with perjury. Signed Major Miller, Commanding Officer, Allied Military Police, Vienna, witnessed by Lieutenant Lashout, MP. And then it has note, Auschwitz was not included in this camp list as it was under the jurisdiction of the Jewish Bolshevik Soviets, not the Allies. And that's a very important line there, I think, because that's where all this alleging of the gassings comes from the Soviets.
But this is, it did, but the West kind of repeated what the Soviets were saying, and hence we've got these people who still insist that gassings took place at places like Buchenwald, which never did, and by the 70s it was more or less proven completely that there was no gassings. But this is an early indication of what they're saying about people lying, and obviously some people tortured to get a kind of confession out of them, because it all stems back to the Nuremberg trial where, there's no real basis of innocence. It was just a contrived spectacle, if you like. And this was, one of the founding, the made-up stories, should I say, that helped convict them.
Was this before or after the Nuremberg trials? Do you know, 1948, January?
48. I think it's not the same year.
Because I'm wondering if this was in response to that, or whether they may have sort of tried to hide this, because they used torture to get the confessions for the Nuremberg trials, didn't they? And they didn't really seem to be that bothered about it.
And a little bit of useless information. Well, not useless information, but there's always a big mystery why of how Goering managed to get his cyanide. Because I don't know if you've ever seen the size of these capsules that they actually bit on. It's not something you can easily hide in your mouth, and they were checked regularly. It's the size of a bullet, to be honest. So people have this impression that, you know, you can hide it under your tongue or in a tooth. But I was reading another interview, this time from Goering's daughter, who actually said that he got the poison from the guards, who were sympathetic, and obviously they'd heard him in court. And he did dominate that courtroom, as I said in The Greatest Story Never Told. So he must have felt, you know, this isn't right and he shouldn't hang.
Well, here's a thought. If that's how much cyanide they needed just for one person, I mean, how are you going to gas lots of people? You're going to need tons of it, aren't you?
Yeah.
If you need like a bullet's worth in size just to kill one person, you know, those tins aren't going to do many people, are they? They're only going to do like 10 people in one of those tins.
Well, you know, the more you look into it, when they're making holes in the roof and you've got to pour these seeds in from this gas, it needs heating up anyway. And like David Cole said, the actual doors opened outwards or inward, no, inwards. So when they all died, you could never open the doors to get the bodies out.
Now, so they had broken the glass first and made their way out
exactly,
that way.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it is such a ridiculous story. They must have known that it was a ridiculous story at the time, and they must have thought, well, we don't want this, you know, we don't want this rumour going about because it's a false rumour. And I guess at the time when this was written, they hadn't really sort of decided that they were actually going to use that rumour and utilise it and make that the excuse for the war, because that's what it turned into. It was like, well, we've got to find something to make the Germans out to be worse than we are so that we've got an excuse for the whole war. I think that was the motive behind it.
They did after World War One, but everybody seemed to sus that one.
Well, they admitted it, didn't they? After World War One, they said, yeah, this was wartime propaganda. A lot of it we just made up. They didn't.
Well, you could say that, but Samuel Altemeyer, in his wonderful speech on declaring Holy War, actually mentions the Belgian babies on bayonets and all that. He was still pushing it.
Crazy. Crazy, the idea that they were bayoneting babies. I was just listening to a podcast actually before this one, Hadding Scott talking about it, and he was saying that it wasn't just accused of the Germans. There were quite a few different nations that were accused of this baby bayoneting sport that they invented, and they would just, you know, project this onto whoever the enemy was to try and stir up the troops. And it was admitted after the first war. But this gassing, they never admitted that that was false, because they thought, well, we can use this. And I guess the Jews were all too happy to go along with it and exaggerate things and say, oh yeah, we saw people being gassed. We saw the bodies. And because of it, they were then able to get all their Holocaust reparations and scare all these other Jews that might happen to them again if any nationalists ever take power. Use it to go after any nationalists and say, well, nationalism leads to gassing all the Jews. I mean, it's turned out to be a very useful and profitable lie for them to pretend is the truth, basically.
Well, I can remember researching, again, in the first documentary, and the actual Holocaust payments were not just made to these people in camps. They were made to any Jew who served or who was actually under in a country under the Nazi regime from 1933 onwards to 1945. So that meant if somebody was in Berlin in 1933 when everything was nice and fine and there was no real problems, but moved to America and stopped on a beach in Florida throughout the war, then at the end of the war, he could claim for his Holocaust pension.
Yeah, it's the wrong way around, isn't it? I mean, it's supposed to be the soldiers that are fighting in the war. They're the ones that are supposed to be looked after and get money afterwards to cope with all their injuries. The people that weren't actually fighting in the war, the people that were put in essentially protected camps where they were fed and housed and kept safe for the whole of the war, they shouldn't be entitled to anything. Nothing at all. They didn't actually give anything up, did they, really? They were looked after.
It's still going on today, though, because now the handouts from the survivor who's now died is passed on to his kids.
And they've got 3D holograms of the Holohope survivors so that they can show to the kiddies and brainwash them with that. And they say that the trauma is passed on through the DNA and three generations of Holocaust victims, and it's all made up. And this is why they say, oh, exposing this sort of stuff, it's hatred, and the people that expose this want to exterminate all the Jews, because they know that this is a capital crime, what they've done.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, they know that you know, if somebody lies and bears false witness about murder, then that it's capital punishment. It should be capital punishment. Now, I'm not suggesting that's the way I think, or the way that any of us think, that, you know, that the Jews should all be executed for this. But the Jews themselves know that would be, in law, that is the punishment for bearing false witness about murder, which is what this is.
And they've got people killed for that.
Well,
can I just say this about the bannings on YouTube? I had a good think about it this week, actually, and I don't think that they thought so many people would now be awake, because I can remember looking at comments just before it closed down on other videos where they were making claims of this, that, and the other, and a whole series of comments underneath was just, we're not having it, the goyim, no. And I think they thought they were losing the battle on YouTube, and have now had to turn to complete banning because – from 2005, say, you know, the internet's just got more and more and more information, until it gets to a point now where some comments were laughing at what they were saying.
What it is now, I mean, they've gone so far that they're not actually putting rules out there and saying, well, if you break these rules, we're going to ban you.
No.
They're saying they've got cookies, and this is what they're doing on Facebook. They've got cookies that they're putting on to people that go on that site, and then these cookies tell them what other sites they go on. Mm-hmm. So if they've got somebody that goes on nationalist channels on YouTube, nationalist channels on Twitter, and then has a Facebook page where they don't say anything about nationalism, they're going to ban them from Facebook because of their activities elsewhere, which is basically saying it's just because we don't like you. It doesn't matter what rules you break, even if you stick to the rules, we're just going to ban you because we don't like you, which is total discrimination and goes against everything that they preach to us about not discriminating against people because of, you know, the way that they are. And that's exactly what they're doing. I think what that's really going to do is help BitChute massively. That's going to get loads more listeners, viewers, rather.
If I can upload a video.
Yeah, if you can get around that little technical hitch that you've got there at the moment. You're up to number 12 on BitChute, aren't you?
Well, I was up to number 12 about 2 years ago. Just thought it won't upload anymore. And this week I tried on your suggestion again. But this time it wouldn't let me upload a photo, because it needs a photo as well. And if you can't upload a photo, it keeps coming back saying your video won't upload because you haven't got a photo. Hence, around in circles we go.
Well, perhaps one of the listeners who is more used to using BitChute, perhaps they can get in touch with you and give you some help with that, because we've got to get your videos back up there. Obviously, people will be missing out on seeing them, especially if you've got a new one and you've got 8 more to upload to BitChute yet. And, you know, they're not available on YouTube anymore. I did hear something funny this week. Mark Cullett did a debate with the Israel Advocacy Group, which is a really quite a famous Jewish advocacy group, and it was a live debate on YouTube, and it lasted for all of 5 minutes after the debate finished before it was cut down, and you got all these all these reports in the Jewish papers and the press about what a terrible mistake it was for them to try and debate him. And they were saying, well, there was 4 of them against him, basically. And one of them ran off halfway through, ran away and hid. And the rest of them were saying, well, it's another Holocaust, and he just wants to exterminate all the Jews. And it's all rubbish. They took that video down because he obviously totally demolished them. But I do recommend people check out the articles, because they are really, really funny. It does.
Well, that's unusual, because they don't usually debate it. Just say there's no argument. It happened, and because it happened, that's why you can't say it didn't.
Well, you have to give him credit for that, actually. I will give them credit for that, for actually having him on and debating him, you know, because most of the time they do just de-platform us. So that's good. But anyway, getting back to these camps, after you sent me this, this memo, I thought, well, let's have a look at what really went on in these camps. And there's a really good website called wintersonnenwend.com. And they've got a lot of articles from the Barnes Review on there and a lot of primary documents all put in one place. And they've got quite a lot of information on there about the concentration camps. So I pulled a few quotes from there that I thought we could discuss here. And the first one is just about the camps themselves. And in 1948, Paul Rassinier, a former socialist and critic of National Socialist Germany, who had himself been interned in the concentration camps of Buchenwald and Dora, published Crossing the Line, or Le Passage de la Ligne. In this work, Rassinier claimed that the Germans had been benign, if not positive, in their motives for putting enemies of Hitler's National Socialist state in concentration camps. Rassinier claimed that the concentration camps were a gesture of compassion, since inmates had been placed where they could not hurt the new regime and where they could be protected from the public anger. Not only did the concentration camps protect antisocial elements, in Rassinier's view, but they were also designed to rehabilitate the strayed sheep and to bring them back to a healthier concept of the German community. According to Rassinier, the German government was helping those whom it committed to concentration camps by putting them in a setting so that they could be rehabilitated into more productive members of the German community. Instead of being vindictive or out to do harm to the communists, the concentration camp at Dachau was designed to reform them and make them into citizens that the Germans could be proud of. Citizens who could return to German society at large and live out their lives as peaceful and proper German men and women. Instead of being an institution aimed at punishment, the German system of concentration camps was designed to reform and re-educate enemies of the new German state. So nothing to do with executing them at all, and half of the reason for it was so that they would be protected from the public who were angry at these people for trying to hurt the new government and the new system, which was doing so much wonderful things for the German people. And this idea of rehabilitation, this is what's missing from the prisons today. And a lot of the time you've got people in there that you can't really rehabilitate, people from the third world, Muslims. I would suggest that there's no point trying to rehabilitate them. But white British people, they could be rehabilitated, I think. Every white person has the ability to, you know, turn over a new leaf or repent of, you know, the bad things that they've done if they get the help to do it. And that's what this was set up for. That's what the system was set up for, mainly to help these Germans that for silly reasons were still following communism, to try and get them to follow National Socialism. Especially
when you look at our system over here, and it's just a vicious circle. You get sent to prison for whatever crime, you come out of prison, you've learned more in prison than what you knew before you went in. And I think the records show that within a year or so, most people are back in prison again because they don't get that help and support.
Well, they were educating them in these camps, and they did have prisons, and they had people that were in the prisons, but they had people that were sort of repeat offenders, and people, as I say, that were enemies of the state, and they needed somewhere else for them, and they took the idea from Winston Churchill, who put people in camps during the Boer War. This wasn't you know, something that was out of the ordinary. And this idea that work will set you free, I mean, that comes from the New Testament, about everybody should work it's a Christian idea that people will find fulfillment from working and doing the very best that they can. And they were trying to teach people that you can get fulfillment, much more fulfillment from working than from taking something that isn't yours, basically. And they may have struggled a bit trying to teach the Jews this, because they tried to do that in Britain as well. When the Jews actually came back, I think it was either when the Jews came back or just before when they came back, they set up places there to try and teach them how to farm and to live off
the
land.
That's never going to work, is it?
Well, they themselves said, all we've ever done is usury. That's all we know how to do is lend money. So they thought, well, we'll try and teach you, you know, to work the land and the fulfillment that you can get from that. It was a National Socialist idea as well, getting fulfillment from work and working for the good of the community. So they were trying to re-educate these people and keep them safe. There's nothing about gassing them, executing them. And also because once you've got the war on and you need people to be working, and so they set up all these industrial plants at where these concentration camps were, or they built them up around the industrial plants, and then they paid people for working there. Which is something that we're not.
Yeah, I don't know where the slave labor comes in.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in the prisons today, they pay you to do work, and if you don't want to work, they don't want you to do the work, because they know that if somebody doesn't want to do the work, they're going to be far more likely to sabotage it, and they're not going to do a good job. So they would prefer that they just stayed in their cells. So it would have been the same with this war effort. They wouldn't have wanted people, you know, working with expensive equipment. You know, if they could sabotage it, they wouldn't have wanted them doing that. So they were actually paying people. I've got some information here about that in a bit. Well, let's move to that now, actually, the payment bit, and I'll move to the other bits later. Payment in the camps. Inmates were not paid for the work, but were given coupons now and then to buy things in the canteen. As the war progressed badly and the number of workers declined, the KZ worker potential became important. Offers of premiums and other advantages were made to the inmates. Tobacco was offered, and even visits to bordellos. In order that these scripts could not be used outside the camps, special money was printed. Got a letter here from prisoner number 11647 in Dachau. He says, I must write you something about myself. I am very well. In the canteen, I buy honey, marmalade, cookies, fruit, and other food. If you worry about me, you will indeed be committing a sin. I have more reason to worry about you. And that's from Letters from the Doomed, Concentration Camp Correspondence, 1940 to 1945. In the Theresienstadt, which is one of the camps that I mentioned earlier, they actually had a payment schedule with the Theresienstadt Krone as the unit of exchange. And working men, according to their jobs, would get 105 to 205 kroner. Working women, according to their jobs, would get 95 to 205 kroner. Part-time workers, 80 kroner. Caretakers, 70 kroner. War wounded and holders of the iron class, first class degree or higher, 195 kroner. Doctors, professors, scientists, or well-known cultural artists and politicians, 145 kroner. So what you've got here, war wounded and holders of the Iron Cross, 195 kroner. And working men, according to their jobs, they could earn up to 205 kroner. And I guess they're talking about all the people there. So they're not saying, well, we're just going to, you know, pay the Germans more. You know, if you were a working man, you would earn as much as the war wounded and the holders of the Iron Cross there.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the first workers' camp to have its own script was Oranienburg. Before using the camp script, they used German currency in nearby towns, but the authorities decided to centralize. Currency was exchanged for camp money, less 30%. Similarly, at Buchenwald, each prisoner was allowed up to 10 marks per week to be used for the purchase of cigarettes at the camp canteen, other canteen purchases, brothel visits, or credit to a savings account. The regulations went on to specify that a visit to a brothel would cost 2 marks, for which 1.5 marks would be kept by the SS, and 0.5 marks would be used for expenses. So I don't think they have brothels in the prisons today, do they?
No, and the excuse is that they were just for the SS. But as you know, they certainly didn't want to be using brothels. The SS were a high moral organisation with race at the top of the list.
Well, they were encouraging the SS to marry people of high genetic quality.
Exactly.
To produce...
I've just sent you a website, by the way. It's one of the best websites I've seen. It covers absolutely everything. It's called the Holocaust Deprogramming. Can't quite make out if it's .com or not. It runs short on here, but I'm sure listeners will find it very interesting.
Holocaust Deprogramming, if they look that up, yeah?
That's the one, yeah.
And as far as the punishment of the inmates and the mistreating of the inmates, the SS actually punished a number of its own men for their conduct while serving in the concentration camps. Two concentration camp commandants, Adam Grunwald and Karl Chmielewski, were placed on trial and found guilty of the deaths of prisoners as a result of brutality in their camps. The SS tried over 700 staff members throughout the course of the Third Reich for their conduct towards inmates. This was because the SS and the National Socialist State always considered concentration camps to be re-education camps first and foremost. So this was really important to them.
Mm-hmm.
That it wasn't seen as being somewhere where people were mistreated. They would invite the journalists in. They would invite politicians in. I mean, we heard last week about how Gudrun Himmler, she had the run of the camps. She was able to walk around the camps and That's see right. them and didn't see anybody being mistreated. And in actual fact, they would see people being freed and they would see the camp commander like shaking their hand and wishing them all the best. And they did do what they could for them afterwards as well. They would set things up so that they wouldn't fall back into crime again. We've got work days in the camps. The work days in the camps were formalised in 1938. On weekdays, the inmates worked from 7:30 till 12 and from 12:30 till 5 for a total of 9 hours a day. On Saturdays, work was from 7:30 until 12 for a total of 4.5 hours. Not only were Saturday afternoons free, but Christian inmates had all of Sunday to attend their own services within the camp and to contemplate the reasons for their imprisonment. I mean, that's not bad, is it?
Doesn't sound like a death camp, does it?
45 hours, that's under 50 hours a week. Under 50 hours a week. And I bet in Britain at the time, I bet the working hours were a lot more than that.
Well, the Germans after the war, the ones what were locked up, captured, not even, they weren't even soldiers. Some were just young boys that were in the cells all day, all night, never got out.
And there's another bit here that really struck me as actually being particularly kind and going beyond, you know, what they had to. And this was about insurance that was paid by the SS. Inside the camp, the barracks were segregated by sex, but in many cases, prisoners were allowed to marry even other prisoners. Registration in such cases was carried out by SS officers. The heirs of any prisoner who died while being held at one of the camps were eligible to collect their life insurance. Since the life insurance policies would expire if the premiums were not paid and the inmates were incarcerated and without any substantial income, the SS came up with a solution that establishment historians will not give them credit for. The SS set up its own fund to pay the insurance premiums of prisoners until the day they died. In this way, the loved ones of incarcerated inmates would not be overly burdened if their relative died while in custody. Imagine that, if you were to go to prison today and the prison officers were to continue paying out your insurance payments that you had on your life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this is before they had the welfare state, but that's basically because people, you know, they have debts when they go into prison. And they're going to get into trouble, aren't they, if the debts aren't paid?
More debts.
Yeah, and the SS actually set this up to pay their insurance premiums. Amazing. More than that, this final one I've got here about parents in camps. In 1936, the question was raised for the first time as to who would take care of the children when both parents were prisoners in concentration camps. Instead of taking the children away from their loving parents, as is now done in countries such as the US and Great Britain, the National Socialist authorities in Germany decided it would be better for the children if the parents were released on a rotating monthly basis, so at least one parent would always be there to care for their needs. This rotating release continued until one of the parents was released for good. Needless to say, this program did pose a slight security risk to Germany, but Hitler was apparently more concerned about the welfare of young German children than he was with anything else. You know, this fuss they make about Donald Trump locking up the children today at the border, which is obviously quite sensible. I mean, if criminals are going to take their children along with them while they going out, carrying out criminal activity, the children have got to be put with them. And what Hitler was saying is, well, what we'll do is we'll let one out every other month so that the children can stay at home and don't actually have to be in the prison. And I think that's far more civilized than what they do today, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
They would just take the children off them today and give them to social services, and they would lose their parents, and the parents would lose their children.
Makes me wonder how many parents have lost their children, though, because I think we covered it not long back when we said that it's not really their children. The last decision is the state because of the birth certificates.
Yeah. The state does seem to think that it owns the children now, and it has a right to educate them in ways that the parents may not want them to be educated.
Well, that's not democracy, is it? When they're being forced, that law is going to come out soon when they're going to teach LBGT to five-year-olds. And a lot of parents are upset, but there is no democracy there.
Well, you have to give credit to the Muslims for standing up to that, actually.
Mm.
And apparently there are some Christians that have been there alongside them, which is good.
I can well imagine. Because some of the parents really don't want a five-year-old to know about it. They'll lose their innocence.
I think it is still in law that if it's primary school children and they're trying to teach them this stuff, that as a parent you can insist that they are not taught it and they are taught something else. I think once they get to secondary school,
there's a law coming out though to override that one.
Yeah, they're trying to change that. These camps, all in all, I mean, there's no evidence for gas chambers. There's no evidence for mistreatment. It was just at the end of the war, when the Allies bombed the supply routes to the camps, in the last 6 months, they had no medicine, they had no food, and conditions broke down. And that was the cause of these emaciated bodies and these starving people when they got there, because they didn't just find starving people. They also found really healthy people, you know, fat, healthy people that looked as if there was nothing wrong with them. Because the people that were looking as if they were starving, it wasn't because the Germans had deliberately starved them to death. It was because they'd caught typhus and they'd caught dysentery. And once you get that, you will lose all your weight really quickly through diarrhea. And that's what was the cause of it. It wasn't torturing or anything like that. The Red Cross, they were allowed in the camps. Every one of these camps, the Red Cross were allowed in. And the camps that the Germans were put in after the war, the Red Cross were not allowed into. And all the provisions and the supplies that were actually there, supposed to be given to these German in the camps, they didn't give them. And those made it an executable, a capital offence. If anybody tried to feed these Germans, they could be shot and killed for doing so. Deliberate starvation.
Brutal.
And projection. You know, projecting these crimes onto the Germans.
That's right. Yeah.
Just to make them out to be more evil than the Allies. That's what it all boils down to. I think they knew at the end of the war, hang on a minute, we have gone a little bit too far with all this terror bombing and everything else that's gone on. And also what the communists have done when they came in, we're going to need to come up with something to cover this up. Otherwise, we're going to go down in history as absolute evil monsters, which is how they portrayed the Germans. I mean, there was that.
That's right.
There was that bit, wasn't there, that you found last
coming
year?
Coming into my back door, that letter.
Yeah, and it was the BBC and the bishops or something, and they were saying about the Red Army.
That's right. They were asked to go along with this great lie because they said they knew what the Bolsheviks were going to do because they'd invaded Poland in 1920, these coming atrocities. The only way we can get around it is to have bigger atrocities done by the Germans. Where in the reality of it all, the bankers in America and in London were telling Stalin what to do. They said, as the commissar said, you know, kill every German, rape all their women, kill that race, because it were all planned. But obviously in this country, people weren't aware of this, so the clergy, I mean, of all people, went along with the lie, as other organisations did, and now it's fact to a lot of people.
Well, they have to they have to keep pushing it, don't they? They have to keep making movies about it. They have to keep having Holocaust survivors on BBC Breakfast Time talking about their latest books. Kids have to be taught it in schools. Every country that signs up to the EU has to have a Holocaust museum. They do relentlessly push it just so that nobody questions it. And it really is shocking for people when they do hear people question it, because they're just so used to everybody believing it, and they think that the evidence is so overwhelming that, you know, you'd have to be a total crazy not to believe it. You know, I've had people really shocked when I've said, well, you know, there weren't any gas chambers and there isn't any evidence for it. You know, and really, really shocked look on people's faces when you tell them that.
Well, the thing is that people can't yet click that it's the only event in history that can't be questioned. And, you know, that is protection which no other event in history has. And if you go against any certain countries, you get put in prison. It's all so crazy that, you know, a neutral person must surely see, you know, something wrong with all this.
Well, it's certainly changed from that first memo, hasn't it? 1948. Anybody that's, you know, talking about this and saying there were gas chambers, bring them to my office. You know, they need to be court-martialed. Mm-hmm. We're not having these false rumours going around. This was a lie that was extracted by torture in confessions. And it's totally changed from that, hasn't it? That does show you that, you know, even though it was a wickedly evil war, and the Allies were on the wrong side, the people that were actually made up the army of the Allies, they were noble, honourable people. I mean, that marshal, yeah. You know, I mean, he's saying, well, this was extracted by torture, so we can't have this going out as a rumour. I mean, he's not one of the ones saying, well, let's make use of this and we'll encourage it so that we can make the Germans out to be worse. Yeah. You know,
obviously, they were unaware of what had been going on in the country for a long time, and they never knew about it.
Lions led by donkeys. That was that was the phrase, wasn't it? So mm-hmm. there were good people, and there were a lot of people that actually changed from communism to being National Socialist. And it said in that book, 6 million people that were communists that turned around to being National Socialist.
Well, the 6 million figure keeps cropping up.
It does. It? And it's six million people he got back to work as well, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. It's one of those numbers.
Is it something to do with the Kabbalah, you know? It's kind of a mystic number because they were using it since 1920s, 1919, even before then. Newspapers were printing, we must send money to Russia to save these 6 million Jews. It's all there in print, you know. So there's something mystical about that figure.
Save them from perishing. These perishing Jews. Always perishing somewhere.
That's right.
What was this other interview that you found this week, Dennis, about the man?
You mean Göring's daughter? Or this other one? I'll tell you in a minute what he's called. Yeah. Adolphus F. We don't know his surname. I've read a few interviews this week, so it threw me for a minute. Yeah, this is a guy who was a communist in Germany at the time around about 1920 when Hitler was starting his campaign. And he actually turned from being a communist and joined the SA and eventually joined the SS. And he gives his reasons why and how things turned around. He never actually looked on the... He was a member of the Red Front, which once they found out that he left and joined the National Socialist, they had absolute hatred for him. But he never quite looked at them like that, not for a long time anyway. He said he just felt that they were Germans who were misguided. But eventually he came to hate them all because of the firebombings and the street fights and everything else that goes with it. But he has an interview, and it's interesting, yeah.
It seemed to me as if it was quite similar today. He was talking about the censorship and the no platforming and then trying to find out where somebody lived. And when they would go out and hold a march, you know, it wasn't hundreds of people. It was just dozens that were on the march and they would be attacked and there'd be rocks thrown at them, bottles thrown at them. Very, very similar to what's going on today and how the SA was formed. To protect the nationalist meetings.
Yeah,
from all of this?
Well, he actually turned. I mean, first of all, he joined the Red Front because he felt, like a lot of people normally do, that this particular party, the Communist Party, was pro-worker and the only one that was speaking up for the worker. You know, but as we know, it's not quite like that. And AP, they kind of formed and was giving these talks. He went along to one of these meetings, liked what he heard. They were talking about, you know, the love for the country and nationalism. And then he went to go watch another meeting, him and his father. His father went as well, first time. They were both impressed. He went to another meeting a few months later where Hitler was actually speaking. Well, that's game, set, and match then, isn't it? Because he just converted everybody with these speeches. But there were Red Front members in that crowd. They were causing problems. And like I said, eventually he did grow to actually hate them because of they were just filled with hate themselves.
And he met a young lady as well, a young Fraulein that was working with the Red Front. And she was their side. And she was screaming in his face like they do today when the left are shouting at us. And he just started talking to her, didn't he? And talking to her on the level and offered to help her out.
Yeah,
she was a homeless girl. And you do wonder if that might work today, talking to these people. But it's like they've got something in their ears. They won't talk. Well, they won't dialogue. I mean, you could see that even with Tommy Robinson when he was trying to talk to some of these leftists and they just weren't listening to anything he was saying, and they were just looking for a chance to get close enough to thump him. You know, they couldn't be civilized. They were like animals.
He called him right wing, and he keeps telling him I'm not right wing, which he's not right wing, but he still gets tainted with that actual paintbrush.
I think that plays to our advantage, really. When people see that there is somebody that is very pro multiculturalism, is just critical of Islam, the religion itself, and he's accused of being a Nazi and he's physically attacked. Mm-hmm. You know, that really wakes people up. That's the sort of thing that does wake people up. I mean, we can talk as much as we like, but if they don't want to listen, they're not going to listen. But somebody that's watching that on the television and sees that, or looks in the Daily Mail and sees this, oh, Tommy Robinson's supporters start a riot, and then they look at the pictures and it's all brown people throwing things, and you've got one white person with a dozen brown people kicking the crap out of him. That's what wakes people up, and they see that you know it's all weighted against us. I mean, even the Muslim Council of Great Britain, they were calling Boris Johnson Adolf Hitler this week. He was literally Adolf Hitler, Boris Johnson.
Yeah, well.
And what are they going to do?
The guy from Bullington Club, was it, in Eton?
Yeah. He was saying his grandfather was a Muslim, Boris Johnson was, because he's a Turk, isn't he?
He's a Turk, yeah. And he also said in an interview while I was watching the other day, he said that many parts of him, he's Russian, he had, as you say, Turkish, one or two others, and he actually said, hold on to your chair, international Jewry.
He said international Jewry, or he was saying he comes from international Jewry as part of this mix.
He said he's got... There's many, many parts of him, like Russian, and he's got some Turkish in him, and he's got other, maybe Irish in him, and he mentioned international Jewry.
Mystery meat, Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
All I can say about him is...
He's going to get a job, isn't he? Everybody knows that he's doing, definitely get a job.
If he does, you know, at least I think he would probably have a good cabinet there as well, because he's bound to give Jacob Rees-Mogg a good job. And you imagine Jacob Rees-Mogg as Home Secretary? I think he'd do a really good job of that.
Yeah, he'd probably do a better job as leader, to be honest. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, of course.
Boris has got this bumbling idiot charisma, which people have fallen for, and he'd done things in London with the Olympics, etc., and he's got a bit of a track record there, and anything negative has been more or less swept under the carpet. So he'll probably get the job, because if I go on TV and say I've got international Jewry in me, doors open all over the place.
That's probably why you said it. But I think that's what we've really got to look at, because I mean, I don't like Boris Johnson. I don't like the fact that he's a Turk, but I do think the people he's got around him are actually the best of the Conservatives. I mean, they're all a bad bunch. But there are a few that are better than all the rest. And I think that's who you'd probably put in his cabinet. And you know, that might work out well for us.
And well, we'll see. Somebody was saying that he is liberal-minded, and if anybody can pull off a second referendum, persuade the public, he can. So we'll wait and see.
Well, I'd like to see him put some sturdy protections in there for free speech, really. I mean, because they've come after him, haven't they, for saying that Muslims look like letterboxes, Muslim females, and accusing him of Islamophobia and all of this. And, you know, so he knows what it's like to just say something that's just a joke and then you know, be accused of Islamophobia and all the rest. So I'd like to see him put some protections in there for us, because you're never going to get that with the Theresa May crowd. It's like the Conservatives. You've got like this leftist progressive part to them, and then you've got a more conservative side to them. And we haven't had a conservative side to them for decades. Might actually get them now. They're never going to support National Socialism or revisionism, but they might support the right to discuss revisionism. I mean, I've heard Anne Widdecombe say that on mainstream television. She said Holocaust denial, I don't agree with it, but I'll stand up for their right to say it. And I think it's terrible that we've got laws in other European countries that encroach on free speech and prevent them from discussing it.
That's right.
You know, to have a Conservative Party member saying something like that, you know, I've never heard any other politician say anything like that.
I don't think she's Conservative. I think she's joined Brexit, I think.
Yeah, she's pretty good, Anne Widdecombe. Mm. She's a traditionalist. But these times back then with the National Socialists, when they were going out speaking, it was the same today. And the worst thing is when you get these groups like Tommy Robinson or Anne-Marie Waters, and they will call the Antifa Nazis and fascists. And you're thinking, well no, hang on a minute. It was the Nazis that fought against the communists back then. And they'll call the Antifa brown shirts. And the brown shirts were formed specifically to keep the Antifa from beating up the nationalists and invading
America,
the meetings. Yeah. And preventing all of that. And it's such a shame that in their desperation to not appear to be Nazis, they end up fudging it all. Because in the end, it looks like they're just arguing who's the real fascist. You know, you've got Tommy Robinson calling the Antifa fascists, and then you've got the Antifa calling Tommy Robinson fascist. And it's like they're just arguing about who is the real fascist.
Who's the fascist, yeah.
Yeah, let's just rise above that.
In all honesty, it's better to be a fascist than what they are.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a fascist. I support fascist ideals. I think
there's a wrong with fascism.
You know, I think you should put the good of the nation before the good of the individual. And if you do that, if you look at your nation like an extended family, and you're all working towards the good of the nation, then you can achieve amazing things. And I think history shows that.
Believe in God.
Yeah. You know, well, it's Christian, isn't it?
It's traditional, isn't it?
That is a Christian ideal, to put the good of the nation before the good of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, I would say, where this fascist idea originates from, is love your neighbour as yourself.
What's even more Christian is all the fascist countries got rid of Freemasonry.
Well, we've just got to wake them up to that fact today, haven't we? The rest of the nationalism that doesn't really understand that and thinks that Christianity is somehow harmful to us, when it's the traditional Christian morals that lead to nationalism.
That's right.
And National Socialism.
When you think about Hitler, I mean, in the countries that the Germans conquered in Europe, obviously they kicked out Freemasonry, but places like Portugal and Spain, they also kicked out Freemasonry. So it weren't just Hitler. Belgium kicked him out.
Well, that's one of the ways that the conspiracy theory guys should understand National Socialism and get behind National Socialism more, because they understand the problem that Freemasonry poses. I mean, people like Henry Mackow and InfoWars and Jeff Rentz, they all understand the problem that Freemasonry is, but none of them seem to work it out that the only people that actually got rid of Freemasonry were the National Socialists.
Well, I argued for ages on YouTube. I mean, and I look around at historians, and even David Irvin, somebody asked David Irvin, how come we haven't looked into Freemasonry when it was wiped out in Europe? And there's nobody except moi who mentions them.
Well, you've made a whole series about it, haven't you?
Yeah, just got worse and worse as I went along.
Exposing
the power they
had. I mean, Michael Jones has done a lot of work in exposing the Freemasons and the start of it. But he doesn't go right the way back like you have, like we have in this series, talking about going all the way back to Herod and before then.
Well, funny enough, I was listening to an interview this week, and it was really interesting about the American Civil War, because the American Civil War was a civil war. The North invaded the South. It wasn't everybody in the battlefield and, you know, all the soldiers get together and have a good fight. No, these were families and cities were torched. And it was actually, when you look at it, the first Bolshevik revolution, and it succeeded in America. Really fascinating.
Yeah, we're told today that was about slavery when it wasn't.
Which it wasn't, because believe it or not, and I didn't know this before I was listening to it, that when the slaves were freed in the South, the slaves in the North weren't.
Yeah, they still had them in the North.
Yeah.
That wasn't what it was about at all.
It was about
the people in the South were sticking together and they wanted to make profits out of the South.
That's right. And Albert Pike were around then. That's never good.
And so much of our history we've been lied to about.
Totally. Hidden and lied.
It goes back a long way. That's why I say, you know, we're lucky that we still do have the Bible there, because that tells you the right way to be, and we know that that's what our ancestors followed, and they can't mess around with that. So we can look at that and see the same morals and that our ancestors followed, the same laws that our ancestors followed, and look at them and see that's the way things should be. And that's what people should be fighting for, not fighting to spread homosexuality around the world.
Well, I'm afraid in this country, I think Christianity is losing every day. I really do. You know, there's less and less people consider themselves Christian.
Well, and the ones that do say that they are Christian, you know, 9 times out of 10, they support homosexuality, they support women priests, they support feminism.
Freemasonry.
Yeah, they just go along with whatever the progressive ideals are that are being promoted. And even the archbishops do that. I mean, before I was even at this, I remember seeing the Bishop of Canterbury, and it was his first speech, and he centered the speech around the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And I can remember thinking, hang on a minute, shouldn't he be talking about something from the Bible? What on earth is he doing talking about some obscure piece of legislation?
Communist literature.
Yeah, well, I didn't know it at the time. I just thought, what's he doing talking about legislation? Isn't he supposed to be the head of the church? And I just sort of put that back of my mind.
I've always felt the Anglican Church was not what it actually seems. I've had this feeling about the Anglican Church for a long time. Yes, it looks religious when they're all going on a Sunday, you know, these Queen and the MPs. But there's something about the Anglican Church, you know, the Archbishop and people like that. It doesn't fit right.
It's just there to serve the state.
Mm.
But what always got me is, okay, I mean, because you always taught, well, there was this Reformation and the Catholic Church, the Pope was getting, having far too much to do with things. They were selling indulgences and it had strayed too far from its course, from the original. So they had the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, why didn't they go back to the original then? Why didn't they go back to being Orthodox? Why didn't they go back to the traditions? Why did they then go out and smash all the churches up and take all the land and give it to the nobles instead of the church and do away with all the history of it? Why didn't they go back to what the church was 1500 years ago if they wanted to go back to the beginning? Why did they have to start hundreds of new churches and sects and with, you know, making doctrines out of one verse from the Bible instead of looking at all of it? Why do they do all of that? Why didn't they go back to the beginning?
Because we're just religious to start with it.
Yeah, well, just asking that question tells you that wasn't what the Reformation was about. It wasn't about going back to how the church originally was. It was about destroying the power that the church had.
Correct. Which has been destroyed. And I wish more people had owned up to that one, because I'm sure some of these historians can see, actually see what the church has become, which is certainly not the church of the old tradition.
Well, if the Jews are supporting it, then you know that there's something up with it. And the Jews were supporting that Reformation. They were helping to print Bibles in English, Bible translations that they had had a hand in. Yeah, they were backing Luther because they knew that it was going to weaken the church.
Exactly.
Instead of
the only power which has stood up against them.
What we really needed was to have a reformation of the church, but that isn't what we got.
Yes.
That's what it's called, isn't it? They call it the Reformation, but it wasn't a reformation. Yeah. It was a revolution. It was the same as all these other revolutions, where they destroy everything that was
there before.
Yeah, and put something worse in its place.
And then, of course, you can't forget the 1,000 priests admitted who infiltrated in America. Dodds, I think she was called. She eventually turned back to being a Catholic, but she did enough damage to wreck the church completely in my eyes. I mean, 1,000 high-ranking bishops and whatever who were actual communists who actually dedicated their life to be a destroyer of the church. They've given up their life, if you like.
Well, they deliberately infiltrated it, didn't they, so that they could corrupt it from within.
Corrupt them, yeah.
Perverts and homosexuals and degenerates, and they deliberately became part of the church, joined the seminary so that they could destroy it.
Yeah, and all admitted.
There's also that letter, isn't there, from ages back, and it's written, I think it's written from the Prince of the Jews to the Jews, and it's saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he says, well, this is what you're going to do. You're going to accept their baptism, and you're going to become priests, and you're going to become a part of the church, and you're going to take it over and subvert it for our uses. And that's what they did. This has always been one of the problems with the church, is because it misunderstood who the Jews were. When these Jews would convert and they had lots of money, they would make a big thing of it. Just like today, when you get like a black conservative or a black Republican, they make a huge thing of it and they promote them. Like they've promoted this Sajid Javid to being the Home Secretary because he's a Pakistani Muslim. It's the same with the church. They would get a Jew. Oh, this Jew has converted. We'll make him Archbishop and we'll put him in charge of the translation university. We'll put him in charge of translations of the Old Testament. That's what we'll do.
Well, I'll tell you how good they are, because the Polish one, I mean, I actually thought that he was the perfect pope. He looked the perfect pope. You know, he walked and looked like a pope, and he turns out to be a Jew.
Which pope was that then?
That was the one from Poland when the wall came down and all this kind of carry on. John, Pope John Paul.
I can't think of his name.
No, honestly, if you saw a picture of him, you'd think that is the epitome of a pope.
Pope Gregory the Great, he was a good pope. I mean, that's a long time ago, over 1,000 years ago. But from what I've read from him, he had a lot of integrity and he wanted the best for the British people. He was the one that sent Augustine over to convert the Angles. And Augustine wasn't a particularly nice chap, but the pope himself... You can see from the letters that he wrote when these new bishops among the Angles were asking questions that he was an upstanding man. It wasn't just words.
You're good popes and you're bad popes. I mean, they're all human actions. After all. But unfortunately, to me, when you look at the abortion vote in Ireland, one of the most Catholic countries in the world, and they have turned against the priests, and rightly so, from what, all this infiltration has done. And now you get more of the white race killing the babies. Sad.
Yeah, that's tragic to see, but at least we've still got people here that reject that and stand up for the truth. You know, you've still got a remnant of white Christians that do stand up for traditional morals and do stand up for traditional interpretations of scripture and are still saying, look, you know, there is good and there is evil in this world. It's not everything is good. You know, there's both.
The video that I had on up on YouTube for abortion, when it showed the actual woman saying, don't worry, you know, we'll flush it down the toilet if you've got any worries. They took that video down.
That's just like with the Canaanites, isn't it? When they would sacrifice babies to Moloch, and the Canaanites, when they because they had actually had Carthage in Africa, and when they dug that up, which is now Tunisia, there were all these like babies in jars where they sacrificed them. We talk about this. Yeah, we talk about the abortion holocaust today. It was the same thing that was going on back then, and it was the same people back then that were promoting it and promoting licentiousness, and, you know, this is absolutely fine sort of thing to do. And it's their descendants that are doing the same today. It's always been the same forces of good fighting against the force of evil right the way through history. Yeah. And and that's what we talk about here. Not just National Socialism. It's not just National Socialism, but all the good guys throughout history. Right, Dennis, we've gone a little bit over time here, so thank you very much for coming on today.
No problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great Midsummer's weekend ahead of you.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.